I think this is actually a really great use of hacking. That's something we always tell our clients is hacking in its simplest form is making something or someone do something they're not intended to do. And that's exactly what this is.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where our expert panelists break down the biggest industry news stories into practical takeaways you can use. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and I will not tell you what was on my Spotify Wrapped this year because I believe in data privacy, and I might be a little bit embarrassed by what was there. Joining me today, Claire Nunez, creative director for the X-Force Cyber Range and a rug maker, as I've just learned, Sridhar Mupidi, IBM fellow and CTO, IBM Security, and making his podcast debut, Ian Malloy, Department Head, Security Research. Thank you all for joining me. Here's what we're going to be talking about. Do malicious LLMs live up to the hype? Hackers can lock you out of Gmail by changing your age. What happens when you get hacked by two different groups at once? And the time solar radiation grounded a bunch of planes and why that matters to security pros. But first, React 2 shell has sparked a cybersecurity debate. Last week, the React team announced that security researcher Lachlan Davidson had discovered a remote code execution vulnerability with a CVSS score of 10.0, so big deal, in React server components. Now, quick PSA, the affected packages are React Server DOM Webpack, React Server DOM Parcel, and React Server DOM TurboPack versions 19.0, 19.1.0, 19.1.1, and 19.2.0, plus any frameworks or bundlers connected to the vulnerable packages through the software supply chain, which means things like Next.js, Waku, Vite, and Redwood SDK, among others. Now, the way this remote code execution vulnerability works is So you have to know a little bit about React server components first. They are little pieces of code that execute activity on a server. The server and the client communicate by way of HTTP requests. Basically, hackers can sneak data into the HTTP request, gets sent to the server. The server decodes it, thinks it's a command, and it executes it, right? So in plain terms, the bug lets attackers turn a normal web request into a command prompt on your server. Now, we've seen attackers exploiting this, and we've seen patches and updates already rolled out. But I'm really interested in the debate surrounding this vulnerability because people have been kind of split. On the one hand, you've got people who likened it to Log4Shell, which was a big deal when it came out, as I'm sure you all remember, and you see that in the name we've given it. But others felt like we're kind of overreacting to this and we're doing a little more harm than good. So Sridhar, I'd like to start with you and get your take on this vulnerability. Where do you think it falls in terms of severity and why?
I think any vulnerability with 10 requires some level of legitimacy and action for sure, right? But the blast surface, in my opinion, is not as big as Log4j. That doesn't mean we can't ignore it, right? We still need to go and take care of it as soon as possible. Like you said, you know, any of the Next.js packages are easy to update, but you know, trying to go and do it with some level of control would be good, rather than what Cloudflare tried to do is to go and release something in panic, and that creates even more chaos, right?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Cloudflare thing, right? Because that's a good example of an organization who, you know, look, good intentions, but they were rushing to get something out and they accidentally knocked themselves off for a little bit. And I think that's, again, part of the reason why people are saying, look, you got to slow down. It's not that it's not important. It's not that it's not serious, but approach it with some intention, right? Anybody have any agreements or disagreements, want to build on what Sridhar said there? Ian, you got anything you want to add there?
Yeah, so I think the interesting thing there is when you have these new vulnerabilities, if they are potentially easy to exploit, what you're going to realize is that the attackers are going to try to exploit them very, very quickly, and you want to maintain the ability to be ahead of them. And that's where, you know, speed is obviously very, very important, but as Sridhar has mentioned, sometimes moving too quickly can become a problem. And, you know, it can have unintended consequences there.
I think it's good to prudently overreact sometimes, and especially when something is very out of the norm. That's important to do. But I do think that it can also hurt you sometimes if you overreact too much. There's a difference between reacting and saying, let me look into this, and reacting where the sky is falling down and you kind of don't know what to do. So I think this is a good time for organizations to evaluate kind of where they're at and where React exists within their architectures and their vendor architectures as well. But I don't necessarily think everybody needs to kind of run around like Chicken Little right now. But it's worth looking around and considering, you know, where does our risk lie?
And I think that's a really good point. Not always knowing exactly what you have deployed. Sometimes your CMDB databases are out of date. You don't necessarily know what you have deployed, where you have it deployed. This is one of the things we learned with Log4j. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind then. You know, having good hygiene on your supply chain.
The other thing, Ian, is that this is one of those things where it's not just a patch, right? It's a patch for sure. You can go do it, but I believe you have to go rebuild and redeploy, right? This is where I think I've seen a couple of customers talk about, yes, I updated it, but I still see it, right? So, and rebuilding broke something else.
Yeah, I'm glad that, so two things. First of all, prudent overreaction. I think that's a lovely little term, and I'm going to keep it in mind for my life in general, but also for cybersecurity purposes. But I also like, Ian, how you brought up that you don't necessarily know right off the bat where this thing might be in your system, right? Like, it requires a little bit of digging. And so that got me thinking about the kind of long tail that this attack could potentially have. It made me think of last week we discussed the Gainsight breach, which is slightly different, but it was people using tokens they had stolen in an earlier breach of Salesloft Drift to gain access into more systems. And it just got me thinking about how one attack on one piece of infrastructure can really branch out in ways you don't expect. And I'm wondering if that influences how we look at the severity of this particular breach. Sridhar, you got any takes on that?
I think the dependency aspect is a key thing, right? That's what I was trying to allude as well, right? Which is, while you may fix something, but the fact that, number one, understand where it is. Two, understand what does it take to actually fix it, right? Patching. Three is trying to look at the dependency of it. Okay, if I fix it, what else may break? So some level of caution in terms of going with a controlled approach is what I would suggest, Matt.
Now, Ian, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on why such a debate was sparked in the first place. I mean, I kind of feel like it seemed like there was a particularly strong polarization here. I don't know, maybe that's just where I hang out online, but I felt like it was more, vicious than I've seen before in a lot of times. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about why this vulnerability sparked such a reaction.
I mean, it's hard to say sometimes. I mean, I think if we went through the Log4Shell, it was huge. As Sridhar said, that was pervasive. It was used everywhere, is a major dependency. React has a lot of the market, and so I think people were expecting it to be much, much bigger than it ended up being. It's also a little bit different in that the Log4Shell, you could attack systems that were in the back end. Here, I think you have to actually have direct access to them. But I think one of the reasons people think we're overreacting is we're not necessarily seeing the exploits in the wild maybe as quickly. And a lot of the exploits seem to indicate that people aren't able to exploit it, as easily and as readily as maybe they had expected.
It's a simplicity of how you can exploit it, right? You don't need to authenticate. You just basically go to, the specific endpoint and execute a code and it just does it. So, sometimes you have CVSS 10.0, which are not so easy to exploit, but this one seems to be piece of cake, right?
And I think these are really strong kind of technical reasons for why, there's been the kind of reaction that we've seen. But I'm also wondering if there's a sort of, call it a cultural component to this. And by that, I mean, we've recently seen a lot of kind of pushback in cybersecurity against specifically how we cover AI-related threats, right? I've seen a lot of people being kind of skeptical about that language. And I think specifically of the MIT report that got kind of pulled down because it said that there were 80% of ransomware attacks used AI. And then it turned out that was kind of bunk. And I do wonder if this is kind of like a perfect storm thing where this is coming along at a time where there's an increasing skepticism around some alarmism maybe in how we cover cybersecurity. I don't know. Do you think that's part of anything?
We as a community are getting more and more paranoid, right? Because, we've got the hype of Gen AI being able to launch attacks very quickly. So we're reacting very quickly to anything like this than what we have done before the era of Log4j.
So Claire, I want to ask you, because you do a lot of work at the cyber range, kind of preparing organizations to address risks and react to things like situations kind of like this, right? And again, that phrase you used, prudent overreaction, keeps popping up in my mind. So I was wondering if you had any advice on kind of how you prepare your organization, your executive leaders, whoever, to approach these kinds of things with that level, that appropriate kind of, you know, sense of proportion. Any thoughts there?
Yeah, so usually, again, we do advise organizations to prudently overreact to things that are new in this space, and to kind of take a step back and maybe move a little bit more slowly to evaluate kind of the risk at hand. So mostly we do advise our leaders that come through the range to really focus on risk assessments, prudent overreaction, and to also continuously just do business impact analysis as well, and to have a good line of communication with their third-party vendors as well, just because if they know that they're going to be changing something because of a critical outage or patch that they're doing, you want to be aware of that so you can ensure business continuity on your side, because you may not have this in place, but maybe one of your vendors does. So those are some of the things that we kind of highlight on, and that applies really to any industry where you do want to know your risk, be able to react swiftly, and to, you know, have good communication with your vendors.
Makes perfect sense. Before we move on to our next topic, I just wanted to throw it to Ian or Sridhar. Do you have any last words aside from patching or updating? Any advice that you would give organizations dealing with this thing at this time? Sridhar, let's start with you. Anything you want to add there?
I think Claire covered it well, right? It's about first is visibility, right? Like, you know, what is the black surface? What's the visibility in terms of to the vulnerability, and you know, how susceptible is my environment to that, right? Second is able to do some level of risk assessment to say, okay, do I need to go and update it? If so, am I going to break something? Or can I just put like a WAF rule or an IP allow or deny list to be able to block that port, right? Meaning, can I do some band-aid approach so that I can buy some time, right? And then once you do the risk assessment, then it's a mitigation or remediation for me, right? Mitigation is something like a WAF gateway. Remediation is, okay, I got to go and update the patch, but do the dependency checking and make sure that you actually fix the root cause. So.
Absolutely. Ian, any final thoughts?
I like what Sridhar has said, but I think a couple of things would add. Maybe just, you know, how can you actually automate some of your testing so that you know when this actually does happen? How can you respond? How can you respond very, very quickly? And how can you not actually create some new kind of errors and, you know, make the problem actually bigger than it was, especially when some of the mitigations end up being quite easy to deploy.
So I think we've covered this pretty well. Let's move on to our next story here. Do malicious LLMs live up to the hype? There's a lot of conversation about whether generative AI is delivering on all of its promises in the enterprise world. And it turns out that some cyber criminals are also wondering whether it's worth it. In a recent report, Palo Alto's Unit 42 analyzed the capabilities of two of the most popular malicious LLMs on the market. We've got WormGPT-4 and KawaiiGPT. Now, unlike mainstream LLMs, these two tools have no ethical constraints or safety filters, and they're mainly sold as tools for, you know, phishing, malware code generation, automated reconnaissance, that kind of thing. Now, some people kind of look at these tools as unleashing a whole new wave of cyber attacks by lowering the barrier to entry and streamlining malicious operations. Others are more skeptical. Specifically, I'm thinking of an article by Nate Nelson in Dark Reading, who wrote that these things fail to live up to the hype. They're kind of only useful for very low-level criminals, and after that, they're just not that powerful. Ian, I know you do a lot of AI security research, so I wanted to throw to you first. You look at things like WormGPT-4, KawaiiGPT. What do you think? Impressive, disappointing, somewhere in between? What's your take on these things?
They make good headlines. It gets people excited. You can see, hey, there is now a malicious use of AI. Are they actually pushing the envelope or anything? I don't really think they are necessarily. I think the barrier to entry to grabbing any other LLM and actually using it for potentially malicious purposes is actually pretty low. Most of the models tend to be fairly easy to prompt inject if you want to get them to do something malicious. On top of that, I can actually just take any normal model, and as long as I'm not explicitly telling it, hey, I'm writing a phishing email. Help me write a phishing email. I just go and say, I'm writing a marketing email. Help me write a marketing email. You know, add some emphasis here. You know, make it critical. The user has to respond very, very quickly. This is urgent. And it'll happily do that. And you can describe a perfect phishing email and it'll write it as long as you don't tell it it's phishing. So the intent is very, very difficult to understand. So that's maybe one of the first things I've kind of observed.
No, it makes sense, right? And again, that goes back to something that we talked about in the last episode, which is that research into using poems to kind of jailbreak your prompt, your models, right? Like if you phrase your malicious prompt not directly, but in verse, you can make it do things it's not supposed to do, right? So like you said, maybe these models aren't even really necessary, right? On that front, it got me thinking about something, which is WormGPT-4 has like a subscription model, right? Like it sells its services to other hackers. And part of me kind of wonders if like that's the whole play for them. Like if it's not even really about, you know, cybercrime, but like they're making money by selling a thing to people. It's a branding play. Maybe hackers are the real, you know, target in a sense. I don't know. Sridhar, any thoughts on that? Do you feel like that could be a possibility there?
Due respect to Ian, right? But he is one of the top of the, you know, researchers in the world in this space, right? Of course, the bar is really high for him and everything is, but look at it from individuals who don't do this on a daily basis. For them, things like, you know, WormGPT or Kawaii GPT lower the bar very, very, very to be accessible, right? Things that we don't know. You know, somebody like Ian, I would expect him to say, okay, write me a marketing campaign and embedded links in there and do the right way. But somebody who doesn't know this is going to say, give me a phishing link. It does not have spelling mistakes from Nigeria, right? That itself is, you know, probably good enough for them to go and researchers in like Ian would probably go for 40, 50%. These guys would probably look for 8%, 10%, right? And 10% of a billion people is plenty, right? So I think there's a market. I mean, Kawaii GPT is free and, you know, the WormGPT is what, $200? Something like that? Easily accessible, right? Something like that, right? So, I mean, there is a market and they're trying to make the hacking democratize a little bit so that it's easy to approach. So we as defenders have to do a better job of at least addressing this lower barrier attacks.
No, it makes a lot of sense. It's like you said, there is like a real market there. You know, not everybody is as skilled as our Ian Malloys of the world are, but that's why, you know, Ian's here at IBM instead of doing that. Claire, any thoughts on your end on these things when you look at them? You know, what do they spark for you?
Well, I'm also wondering, besides just like creating phishing emails and such, these probably also have other nefarious use cases, right? Like helping you do malicious research of some kind, maybe generating photos that are, you know, you can't generate with a ChatGPT because there are certain safeguards there. So I'm sure there's other use cases too that individuals would, you know, try to access these for. And, you know, the hacking ones of creating a phishing email or such, I'm sure that's just kind of like a nice to have for some of these users. But I think that on the topic of like, are these worth it kind of thing? I mean, I guess it depends how you use them. So if a hacker is going to use them just to spell check or something, maybe not. They could maybe use Microsoft Word for that or like a free plugin. But, you know, if you really want to do a lot of different things in terms of generating photos and then maybe it's worth your criminal money. That's kind of my thought on it. AI improves your phishing and research overall. You just have to know how to use those tools.
That makes sense. And it reminds me that I think it was WormGPT that they kind of said that, look, part of our training set is like, you know, malicious stuff specifically, like, right, like phishing emails, malicious code, whatever, the idea being that it would be even better generating some of that stuff for you. But that does still raise the question, right, about like hallucinations and those kinds of things that we still see happening in vibe coding with legitimate LLMs. And I just kind of wonder, I don't know, is that also throttling our AI malware the same way it's kind of throttling some of our ClearNet development? I don't know, Ian, any thoughts there? Like, do you think that the hallucinations stop it from being super powerful with malware? What's your take?
And I mean, it definitely could. I think some of the articles kind of question whether or not people are getting the performance boost that they were. But I think we've been making the same kind of comments about just Gen AI and vibe coding. And actually, if you're not a skilled developer, it actually can cause a net negative through some studies. And so we're probably seeing a little bit of that as well.
Sridhar, I wanted to ask you, because you brought up that QuietGPT is different. They don't charge for it. It's a kind of open source community approach. It's freely available on GitHub. According to Palo Alto, it's really easy to set up. I was wondering what your take was on this approach of like an open source malware community, basically. Like, it personally, it's not something I haven't quite seen before, but I'm also not as seasoned in the space. What are your thoughts on this thing?
You know, when you make it open source like this, it is not only assisting the bad actors, but can potentially be used by the good actors to say, hey, let me go test to see, you know, how easy my system is to be vulnerable for this, right? Or be able to learn from that to be able to use that as an input for my red teaming or my blue teaming, or, you know, a combination that that can result in doing a better job of security coming in from a hacker mindset, right? So to me, I think this becomes a collaborative effort where the bad guys are doing a great job of collaborating with each other anyway. And when you keep it in the open, at least we know some of the tactics and procedures that can help us in terms of building better software.
I like that a lot. You know, kind of a there's a constructive use for this kind of thing, right? If you're smart with it, you can make it work for you. I really like that. So to round out this segment, I just wanted to ask if we have any kind of final takeaways for defenders. Should the existence of dark LLMs kind of change anything about what we do or stay the course? And I'll just go back around. Ian, any thoughts on your end? Should we adjust in any way?
I mean, everything that an LLM can do, a human can do effectively. So it's really about the rate and pace and the scale. And that really then comes down to, I think, what Sridhar is saying, you know, automating all of your pen testing, finding your vulnerabilities. We're seeing lots of companies do this, you know, automatic fuzzing. You know, Google, Microsoft, and others are starting to do this and starting to build these automatic pen testing capabilities, where if you can capture everything through an AI agent, for example, using some of these tools before you put it into production, that's going to make it that much harder for them to attack it once you actually do release it.
Absolutely. Sridhar, anything on your end to add there?
These will become norms, right? And, you know, and throughout this discussion, I'm sure we'll have more topics, even if you go back to the previous topic and this topic, we just have to become more agile, more dynamic in our security, right? And so what that means is, okay, you know, FIDO or passkeys is no longer an option, right? You have to assume that every email is not trusted, right? You have to assume certain things and build security around that, right, as defenders. So that's the way I would look at it, to say you'll see more and more and more of these. The challenge is for us as defenders to say, how do we raise the bar to make the security more adaptive, more dynamic, more resilient?
Gotcha. And Claire, any final thoughts on your end?
Yeah, I agree with Sridhar on all of those topics. I think something that has come up a lot with clients and in kind of CISO roundtables lately is that we really need to be using AI to our advantage as well. And threat actors are going to level up with it, so we have to as well. There's a lot of great options out there, as Ian mentioned, to kind of do that. So it's important that organizations, instead of just kind of forgetting about it a little bit, is thinking about how they can better integrate it into their security as well.
So I think the kind of takeaway here is that even if these things maybe aren't as impressive as they sometimes sound in the headlines, we can't rest on our laurels, right? Like, there's still plenty of work to be done there to make sure that our organizations are prepared for when these threats do become as powerful as some of the headlines make them sound. Let's move on to our next story. Hackers lock users out of their Gmail accounts by changing their ages. It's a pretty simple technique. First, they break into your account, often by just stealing your credentials. Then they change your age to 10 or something else that makes you look like a child. And that means they can add you to their family group where they are a parent. And now they have total control over your account. And there's no way for you to get back in. Even Google can't do anything to help you yet. And that was kind of on purpose, right? Google was making it so that children couldn't circumvent the controls of their parents set, and hackers have used this against them. Now, Claire, I know you have some thoughts on kind of how this might align with some new regulatory efforts to spin up an even bigger problem. Walk us through that.
Yeah, so first off, I think this is actually a really great use of hacking. It's hacking in its simplest form, right? So it's making something do something it's not intended to do. So it's, you know, like a meal hack kind of thing, but it's for technology. So that's something we always tell our clients is hacking in its simplest form is making something or someone do something they're not intended to do. And that's exactly what this is. But it's very interesting because Google rolled out, I think, these parental accounts a couple years ago. But in Australia recently, there have been social media bans where if you're under, I believe, 16 or 15 years old, you cannot use social media. Instagram has recently rolled out teen accounts that have different parameters around it. So my thought is that this could become a bigger threat than it has. I mean, we've seen people's accounts be compromised in different levels because they clicked on something they shouldn't have. But perhaps this is something that will scale more broadly as people or as these platforms start to roll out these teen accounts or child accounts, because instead of just completely preventing users from being on their platform, they want to have these users, you know, for life and have them graduate into adult accounts. So I think it brings up a lot, you know, that's a potential for what can a threat actor may do. And a lot of people would probably be willing to shell out a decent amount of money to get their Gmail accounts back, to get their Instagrams back. If you get locked out of those, there's a sense that your life is lost. Whereas other platforms, you could very simply just make another account. But if you can't get into your Gmail and you can't get to perhaps your bills or something, whatever is in there, that's very scary. And I could see people shelling out a lot of, I think they reference gift cards. So shelling out a lot in gift cards to get their accounts back. And who knows if they are ever reverted to whatever age they actually are, or if they just get to stay 10 forever.
There are two things there that I want to kind of pick up on. The first is, like you said, I can see, you know, a scenario where this becomes almost like a method of wiping accounts, right? Like if you think of the Australia social media bans, I think it's like people under 16 just can't have an account flout out anymore. And it's almost like, again, I don't know if this would work, and I'm not trying to give anybody ideas, but I could see a situation where you get on there and you change someone's age, you basically destroy their account, delete it, it's gone, right? And then the other thing that you had mentioned too was that this is a kind of situation where people might be willing to pay a lot of money to get these things back because they're very, very dear to us. And it got me thinking about, I don't know, is that like a fundamental flaw in how we approach our security or our security hygiene, that we rely on such a free service like this for so many things? Ian, let me throw it over to you because you know much more about this stuff than I do. Any thoughts on that or this attack in general? What are you thinking here?
I thought there are a couple of things interesting. Yeah, all roads seem to lead to Gmail. And yeah, once you get locked out of that, you know, you lose access to just about everything else. But I think it's the unintended consequences of that, you know, like how difficult it is to get access back. The fact that Gmail is effectively an unsupported service because it is free. So there is no tech support you can call up and complain to. The different forums I saw seem to indicate that if you have it tied to a YouTube account, you actually have to go through YouTube to get access to it. So unless you have, you know, a channel there. And that seemed to be the only kind of road. And trying to figure out, well, what is the way to get access back when you actually do put all of your eggs in this one basket where you have no recourse?
Yeah, no, I think it's extremely scary. Sridhar, I want to bring you in here and get your take on it, and also specifically on this being a situation where they're using kind of well-intentioned controls to do some harm to us. Like Claire said, it's like hacking in its purest form. What's your take on this whole situation?
I think there's a couple of dimensions over here, right? I mean, first, just picking up where Ian left, right? This is not a new, you know, revelation. This exposure has been there for almost a year, actually, right? And Google has still not fixed it. So that kind of goes to the point that Ian is saying is, you know, it'll happen when we'll make it happen, right? So for me, I think it's a couple of things. If you're really relying on the single point of failure, right, across all the things, then make sure at least it's done right. Like, don't use passwords, use passkeys. Right. Make sure that there's some level of a token or, you know, that credentials cannot be stolen. So if you're putting everything into one place, make sure it's a good, solid safe. Right. I'm not advocating for that, but if you're doing that. But the other dimension is, yeah, I mean, this is a single point of failure, which has your not just email, but your financial information, your pointer to your bank statements, pretty much everything. Right. I'm not giving my IBM address to my financial statements. Right, that's what I'm doing. So it's better to do a little bit of a defense in depth and have a different account that provides access to your sensitive information and use this for probably non-sensitive, right? So trying to combine your, what we do in enterprises, we say that go and discover data, classify the data, and protect your sensitive data differently than non-sensitive data. I think we should try to do the same thing, right? I think that's where my head is at, right? In terms of, okay, if you're using it, use it correctly. But if you're option not to use it, then try to think about how do you safeguard your most sensitive information with the right set of tools versus using one for everything, right?
I think it's an extremely good point, you know, bringing up this concept of defense in depth and kind of being able to apply that to so much of what you do. Ian, I think I might have cut you off. You want to jump in there?
No, I was going to ask the question. I mean, how many email accounts do I actually need to make myself more resilient to these types of threats? And
right.
And then you have another problem. Like I have a passkey. It's a YubiKey, right. I can show you right now. And unfortunately, it died on me this morning. So I can't log in remotely because my YubiKey died. And so I was thinking about this, like, what would I actually do? I now have to have one of the recovery accounts, which might be my wife. And now that's another potential weak link.
I'm using a passkey as an example of the defense, but, you know, one should use more than one passkey, you know, as an example, right? Something like a hardware device that you have, you can use your Touch ID, right? As well as have backup mechanisms where you're not just saying that this is a child account and something happens, you cannot unlock it, but having, like you said, your partner or your extended family be able to open that. Those are the techniques that one can use, right? So
backup YubiKey at home, so I'll be able to get back in, no problem. But I was just thinking about, you know, these, you know, the resiliency problem that we actually have here. And then kind of leaning back on this notion of, you know, the unintended consequences of these different security procedures. So when you actually give someone else access to unlock your account, can that be weaponized? And I think this is maybe what Claire is saying. Everything is at some point going to be weaponized, and there's going to be some unintended consequence that someone didn't think about when they designed the system. And that's kind of the mentality we have to get into with these.
To add another layer, so I don't know about, like, Ian, you have a YubiKey. I have a key thing on my laptop. Sridhar, you mentioned passkeys. If you're somebody who's not technically savvy, you may not have any of these things implemented. And I'm not sure about the customer support that Gmail has for free users, but I've recently had an issue with my Meta account where I'm trying to figure something out. There's some kind of like weird block on my account and I'm trying to get it fixed because I'm trying to sell things on Facebook Marketplace. And I can't contact Meta unless I pay to contact Meta. So there's another issue there where it's like, if you don't want to pay for a subscription to one of these services, and maybe, I don't know if Google has the same policy, but if it were on a platform like Meta, this would be a huge issue, and all these people would also have an issue. And think about all the payment information that is also stored in Meta or where else it's connected to, because it's almost, I see Facebook as an option a lot more frequently as a login option. So it's kind of like we put a lot of trust in these platforms, but if you need help, you might not be able to get it, especially if you don't have any of those, you know, extra access options enabled.
Yeah, I think that's an extremely good point, right? And again, it comes back to this concept of so much like of our load-bearing internet infrastructure is like free services, right? Which like turns out to be a double-edged sword in this way, because like you said, you have to pay to get your account back. Nobody wants to be faced with that, right? And Ian, I also wanted to just spotlight before we move on this notion that you had said about everything can kind of be weaponized eventually, right? And like even the protections you put in place can, like, under the right circumstances, become weapons in their own right. That's what we're kind of looking at here, right? Like that is exactly that situation. And so you're kind of foreshadowing something, this resilience conversation that I hope to get into in our final segment. But on that note, we do have to move on to our next segment. When ransomware reveals a bigger threat. Researchers at Positive Technologies shared a curious case where a ransomware infection ended up alerting its victims to the existence of a much quieter and separate APT, or advanced persistent threat, lurking in their network. While investigating a victim's compromised system, the researchers found evidence of Quiet Crabs, which is an espionage-oriented APT known to quietly dwell in systems for hundreds of days. How did they find them? It's because a much noisier attack, believed to be the work of ransomware gang Thor, was also underway. Whereas Quiet Krabs uses unique tools and tactics, including speedy exploitation of new vulnerabilities, Thor used some commonly known tools, which meant they triggered more kinds of alarms and called attention to some of this activity, and Quiet Krabs got caught in the kind of crossfire. Sridhar, I'm wondering what this story tells us about APTs and particularly how hard they are to detect. I mean, this is a situation where we didn't even know there was one until somebody else showed up. How confident can we really be that something's not lurking in our systems right now? And the we, I mean, it's just general users, right? Go ahead.
It is hard, right? I mean, APTs by design are silent and not noisy as some of these things that you see. They're supposed to be advanced and persistent, and that means they're just lurking and patient, right? And part of the reason why, I mean, we do the threat intelligence report every year, right? And every year I'm surprised to see that the number of days to identify a threat is like 300, almost a year, right? And that tells me that anybody who is making a lot of noise is going for a quick buck, right? But the real money is in this advanced persistent test where they will play the long game, which is make sure that you're not just go and circumvent the controls on the endpoint, you know, go and reach out to command and control, silently move laterally until you're confident about doing something, right? So it's lucky that we were able to find this, you know, Quiet Krabs through some noisy attack, but not many people are as lucky, right? Until you get to certain situation where it is probably a little bit too late. So yeah, I think, APTs are dangerous, and just because you find something, that doesn't mean you need to stop looking, right? You need to, even after you find out that you probably remediated it, it's good to continue to look beyond the D-Day to see if there's any activity which is different behavior, right, than what you expected.
Yeah, I like that point. Just because you find something doesn't mean it's time to stop looking, right? There's more digging to do. Ian, any thoughts on your end here?
Yeah, it's kind of like that proverbial iceberg. But I feel like this wasn't actually the first time we've actually seen this as well, where you went and there was one very, very noisy attack. Someone maybe tripped or made a mistake, and then you're actually able to discover that there was someone else who had actually been in the network multiple times.
Look, not all of us are going to have a silver lining in a ransomware attack, but sometimes you do have that silver lining, right? It's quite funny. Claire, any thoughts on your end here?
I really love the name Quiet Krabs. It sounds like a beachy indie band of some kind. Really great name. And really works for, their stealth in the network. So I really like that. And they probably are moving laterally like a crab. I think APTs are also just very interesting in general. A lot of people are, like you mentioned, I think Sridhar, you said, looking for the quick buck and curious or concerned about ransom. But I think people should be more concerned about APTs because they are in your network and they are waiting for the right moment to strike. And they, you know, if they're just hanging out there, they can do that on a weekend or a holiday, or they're ready. They're waiting for the moment they're ready, not just to encrypt systems to make money quickly. They're exfiltrating. They are working on their ends to wait so they're ready, so you're not ready. So I think people should be a little more concerned about them. And people don't always want to admit that, oh, we weren't detecting anything within our network either, that we've been sitting here for 300 days and haven't recognized that. So I think a lot of people don't want to admit that they are concerned about APTs either. Or to say, like, we would detect that very quickly, and perhaps they wouldn't. And it's evident that they wouldn't, because lots of organizations are breached and attacked each year by these groups.
Yes, yeah, like Sridhar said, right, in IBM's own research, the cause of the data breach report, routinely it's like it takes like 300 something days to like detect and remediate a breach, right? So it's like, you're not alone. Like, you know, maybe that's one of our messages here for folks is like, don't feel ashamed of that. Like, okay, might have taken some time, but you are not alone. You're the norm with that kind of thing, right? Now, we can't always like count on threat actors to be noisy, and we can't always count on the noisy ones to kind of give away the other ones. So I'm just wondering if we have any thoughts, you know, looking at this, does this change anything about how you think about how we investigate threats? I mean, Sridhar, you already said, you know, don't stop looking just because you found something. I think that's a really wonderful way to put it. But I just wanted to open it up before we move on. Any last thoughts here? I'll start with you, Ian. And any last advice you'd give organizations when it comes to APTs?
Well, definitely you could be proactive. You can constantly look at your logs. You get to run different analytics. I think with the additional automation that we actually have now through agents, you could take any threat and where you might not be able to have a human actually spend the time to go through and investigate that, you can just let an AI agent go and run through your logs, do these different correlations, pull down different threat intelligence. And what it might be is like at the time, this was not known, but new piece of information came out. And as you're constantly churning away at it, you might realize that, hey, this was actually the connection that we actually needed to realize that, no, this was not just background noise. This was not like a one-off. This actually was potentially an incident. The last thing I'm able to say is I always heard there is two types of companies, those who know they've been compromised and those who don't know they've been compromised yet.
It's a very good way to put it. And I also like, yeah, this idea of this is a really good use case for AI agents, like you said, right? Like you might not be able to put a person on investigating all this stuff, but you got agents. That's a good way to put them to use. Sridhar, any thoughts on your end?
I'm a little bit worried, right? Like, you know, 2025, the number doesn't change, right? Still almost a year before we find. I think we need to start thinking about, you know, how do we go after these advanced persistent threats activity more proactively, right? Whether it's threat hunting, whether it's doing behavioral analytics, you got to change the game a little bit too. And Ian's point about, fine, maybe it is a human bottleneck, so fine, let's use digital workers as a way to go through that. I think we need to start embracing a little bit more proactiveness and hopefully we'll bring down the number from 300 to less than that.
Absolutely. And Claire, any last advice for organizations when it comes to APTs?
Back to kind of what I mentioned earlier, prudently overreact. If you notice something that's a little strange, don't just consider it like a small anomaly. It could be something bigger. As Ian mentioned, agents will really help you look into some of those lower level alerts. It's important to kind of be able to cover your bases and at the same time, rely on agents and not burn out your security staff either.
If I remember, wasn't that how they found the RSA breach? One person found something, everyone said they were overreacting, but they just kept sticking at it until they finally uncovered the entire threat.
So that's a perfect kind of example of why it's, you keep digging, why it's worth doing that digging. Let's move on then to our final segment because we are almost out of time here. Airbus flights grounded by intense solar radiation. Now, I like to end the show with something kind of ridiculous or wacky, and I think this is a really good one in that vein. 6,000 jets needed to revert their systems to an earlier software version after it was discovered that bursts of intense solar radiation were corrupting data in the newest software and disrupting critical flight controls and even leading to some injuries of people when we saw some sudden, you know, planes kind of suddenly losing altitude and whatnot. Now, none of us here are physicists, so I'm not asking anybody to talk about how solar radiation works and what you can do about it. But instead, I just wanted to, this whole thing made me think about an aspect of cybersecurity and system resilience that I feel like gets less attention, at least where I hang out it does, which is these threats to our systems from things other than human hackers, right? The natural world, natural disasters can shut us down. Not even disasters, solar radiation, you know? So I'm just wondering, you know, we'll do a quick roundtable here. Do you think our security approaches today address this issue enough? And if not, how can we make them better? Claire, I'll start with you. Any thoughts there?
So I think the impacts of this are still kind of going on a little bit. I've heard of so many flights being delayed still, and no one likes an airline disruption. That is like the one industry where continuity being disrupted is the absolute worst. I think a lot of organizations are actually thinking about the meeting point of acts of God or weather and nature and cybersecurity or cyber resilience and business resilience. We have a lot of clients come through the range that will say, we want to frame our scenario around a snowstorm and we're an organization in Texas. And like, because that happens, right? Your continuity will be disrupted. And if there's a cyber attack, and you need to get to people and tell them that their power is still going to work, or their water utilities or whatever are still going to work. You have to practice that. So I do see a lot of organizations thinking about, you know, this is during wildfire season or hurricane season, and thinking about what would happen if our data centers went out on this side of the country when we operate on this side of the country because of natural disasters. So I think a lot of organizations think about, okay, and how are we still going to continue, whether it's a natural continuity issue or cybersecurity? Because as mentioned earlier, APTs will just kind of sit in your network and wait until you are at a bad place. So if they are, you know, following the weather of wherever you are and there's a hurricane, and that they might choose that moment, it's not impossible. So I see a lot of organizations kind of working on this. More should, though.
Yeah, that, and I'm glad to hear that you're seeing that. And I think like the Texas snowstorm is such a good example of that. We've all seen the sort of news stories about Texas grinding to a halt when certain amounts of ice hit them. So that's a good thing. But you also bring up, before I continue the roundtable, just a real quick question. You also bring up the idea of hackers kind of taking advantage of this, you know, sort of natural disasters and the like to wreak some more havoc. And I have a question here actually from one of our producers about, would it be possible for a hacker to duplicate this kind of solar radiation damage using, I don't know, UV or something? Ian, Sridhar, any thoughts on that? Is this a duplicable thing you could do, you know?
I would take a step back, right? This solar radiation is just a symptom of a bigger problem, right? The problem is there are going to be situations that will impact the system availability, resilience, and operational resiliency, for lack of a better word, right? That juxtaposes with cybersecurity. Now, that could be temperature. Yes, of course, you can. Somebody can crank up the EMF. We've seen that in the movie, right? Or whatever, forget the movie now, Ocean's 11, I think. So I kind of look at those as an I look at the solar radiation as an example of these external calamities that can impact the operational aspect of a system that, number one, that results in bad situation like the airline situation, or number two, that somebody can take advantage of it and misuse for a different thing, right? But the core thing is, how do I design system to be operationally resilient so that I can minimize the cybersecurity impact of that?
Makes perfect sense. And it kind of sounds like maybe this is something that would more happen in a movie in terms of hackers exploiting UV to duplicate the damage, you know? But it's
not even that, right? It's not even that. Like, let's say, for example, in the same plain example, you have a 3-mile redundancy. It's the same hardware, it's the same software running 3 times. If it's going to fail, it's going to fail all 3, right? Instead, I think we need to think about a mechanism by we introduce a diversity where, fine, you may have, you know, hardware version A and software version 2 and hardware version B, software version 2, so that you're thinking about a resilient system, right, versus, you know, some movie situation where somebody's going to steal an EMF generator, right, or create solar radiation. It could be as simple as exploiting the same software 3 different times, right? So...
No, yeah, I like that a lot. You know, putting the focus really on the concrete activity you can do instead of some of this sort of wilder stuff. Ian, we'll end here with you. Any thoughts on your end in terms of how we approach this stuff, if we're doing a good enough job, if we could do better? What's your take?
Yeah, I think just kind of adding what was already said, I mean, there's always going to be like a weak link. There's going to be, you know, dependencies of systems that we're not expecting. You're going to have cascading failures. I remember the 2003, Northeast blackout because one power plant went out. We're reading as a result of some other studies, like there's a single chain link fence in Kansas, and if you cut the link there, it causes, you know, massive outages. If you think about software, and this maybe was kind of going back to the React, when you have like a single dependency, it's the proverbial one person in Kansas maintaining a project and everything depends on it. We just don't really know. And I think that's really the problem, is that we don't know where the weak links are when they fall over, typically until they do fall over. And then if you think about having, you know, backups and, you know, disaster recovery, they're not always tested. And a lot of the times when you actually go and you try to test your backups, typically with a ransomware incident, you find out that, oh, they've not been working, or their tapes are corrupted, or someone overwrote them. And so really it's thinking through all these different things that can potentially happen, analyze it, determine where the weak links are, where you don't have the protection and the redundancy that you think you do, and then kind of making a plan for that.
Awesome. That's a great way to end it. Thank you for being here, folks. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Sridhar, Claire, and Ian. Thank you to the viewers and the listeners. Shout out to YouTube commenter at the bar who shared some thoughts on our last video about how devs could protect themselves and their brands during software supply chain attacks. I love hearing from people about this kind of stuff, so please, please weigh in if you have thoughts. As always, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there and test your backups, I guess.